The animal soul is not that way. The animal soul is extremely selfish. That is what is at its core. Everything comes as a result of that. The abode of the Nefesh HaBahamis is in the heart. Which means that the character of the Nefesh HaBahamis is very much connected to the emotional experience of man. Just as the blood is connected to the heart, and it extends to all the organs, over here it also extends to all the organs. At the core of the Nefesh HaBahamis is the sense of I, is the sense of ego. This then extends to all the organs which implement the feelings, the lusts, wants of the Nefesh HaBahamis. So the legs, if the Nefesh HaBahamis is angry, the legs can implement that anger in a concrete way, or lusts, or passions, or boasting, whatever it may be. In addition to that, he says, it also ascends to the mind to think about the passions, to meditate upon them, and to become cunning in them. Which means it doesn't remain in the heart. It goes to the mind also, but the mind is a product of the heart. The intellect follows the emotions. It doesn't begin with truth. It begins with a sense of I. And the I already creates certain givens. Now the mind comes into the picture. The mind is employed to define what you want, how you want it, what would be the best thing, how to get it done. But the mind is a din in the heart. The mind is subservient to the heart, it's not the other way around. So, you'll ask a person, you love Szechuan beef. Yeah, a person loves Szechuan beef. Why do you love this beef? Because you have to. There's a certain truth to this love. There's a certain vision of what truth that dictates this love. No! Because you love yourself. And since you love yourself, you love things that enhance the self. And one of the things that enhance the self is a good taste. When the body experiences good taste. So you love that. It's just that the mind tells you what is good for self. So that's why a child won't gravitate towards money. A child will gravitate towards a little truck, a little toy. And an adult already understands more about life, so he'll gravitate towards money. Or towards delicious food or cuisine, whatever it may be. But the point is the same. Both of them were motivated by the same thing, the self. And the self loves itself, and therefore the self loves this. Your mind comes into the picture of what is good for you. So in the child, what is good for the self? A little toy. The adult, the mind, says, that's not good for you. What's good for you is, huh? A big truck. A big truck. So of course the mind plays a major role in the Nefesh HaBahamis. But the mind is an instrument and a vehicle that's serving already the I. It's serving the heart. The Nefesh HaLakis, he says, is the other way around. Where is it? It's abode. The abode is in the mind. In other words, the Nefesh HaLakis is guided by a vision of what's true. Since this is true, therefore I gain a liking towards it. So it extends to all the organs to implement that vision, and also to the heart it extends. But the heart is already a vehicle, an instrument, which the mind utilizes. Since this has truth in it inherently, there is vision, there is destiny, therefore it gains a liking for it. So its emotional experience is based on what's true, on what's right, on what's correct. Not that what's right and what's correct is based on what you feel and what you like. It's the other way around. That's the difference between the Nefesh HaLakis and the Nefesh HaBahamis. This is connected also to the blood and to the oxygen. In the heart itself, he says, connected to symbolic in the left ventricle. Because the left ventricle is that aspect which produces the blood, which symbolizes the instinctive heartbeat and vitality of life. It symbolizes the biological essence of life. The oxygen is much more subtle, and the mind is the power of awareness, of consciousness. What is the difference? The Nefesh HaBahamis is not guided ultimately by an intellectual awareness and consciousness of what is true. what is at the source of it is the physical concreteness of reality. The instinctive beat of life. The biological essence of life. At the essence of the nefesh abahamis is ki adam hu nefesh. The blood is the soul and the soul is the blood. Ultimately. The nefesh alikis begins its reality with awareness, with consciousness, with the probe, with the search, with the yearning of what is true in life. The nefesh abahamis hence is impulsive. Its reality originates and stems where? In the biological, physical essence of man. That is at the core of its lessons. Everything else follows that. The fact that I live, I'm here, and I want to be here. The nefesh alikis begins its reality with awareness, with an intellectual search of what is true and what is right. What is right. Now, if these two souls, as mentioned many times, would be, one would be living in Beijing, and the other one in Alaska, wouldn't be such a problem. Problem, or even if they would be living in the mind and in the heart, but keeping, minding their own business, it wouldn't either be such a problem. Problem is that they're living in one body, and they were given the same brain, and the same hands, and feet, and eyes, and ears, and heart, to their disposal. And each one is interested in dominating man's whole life. So this dynamic is what creates the drama of each and every one of our lives. This is what creates the perpetual struggle that's ongoing and exists in every single day and moment of our life. It's the struggle between the reflective self and the impulsive self. It's the struggle between substance and spirit. It's the struggle between self-assertion and self-negation. It's the struggle between selfishness and selflessness. The struggle between egotism and transcendence. It's the eternal disputation between the desire to be earthly, mundane, animalistic, and the unendless yearning in man to transcend his own parameters and to touch the divine. So on one hand, we have an animalistic soul, and that animalistic soul, what is at its core is the I and the ego. And we all experience this. This is what we immediately come in contact. This soul is the essence of physical life, and its whole personality ultimately evolves physical life. Which doesn't mean it can't be intellectual. Which doesn't mean it can't be poetic. It can fantasize and dream and create beautiful philosophies. And ultimately we call it a blood. A creature which is connected to the blood. Because even the melody, the poetry, the ballad of this soul, ultimately at its core is the sense of I, the sense of ego. The divine soul, however, is also a reality that exists within man. And this divine soul wants to relate to things not based on what my given ego declares. Based on what is true. What is really reality. And this imbues a man with a certain sense of idealism. And a sense not to be content and to be happy with just satiating his or her impulses moment by moment. There's an inner consciousness that wants to connect to what is true, what is absolute. What is eternal? And what is ultimately true, absolute, and eternal in life? There's only one thing. The Creator and everything that's connected to the Creator. That is the truth of reality. So this creates the momentum and the dynamic that guides the nefesh alikis day by day, moment by moment. It's unendless yearning and quest to connect with the absolute reality. That is at the core of the animal soul. So all its kaychas, all its attributes, all its faculties, intellectual, emotional, mediums of instrument, the instruments of expression, the mediums of expression, ultimately, what are they? What is their ambition? What is their yearning? What is their quest? Is to fulfill the most inner ambition of the divine soul. And that is to connect to what is true in life. So it doesn't mean that the mind, that is the divine soul. The mind can be used for the animalistic soul. It means that faculty in man, which is closest to perceive, which is the vessel for the character of the divine soul, is the mind. Because the mind, in its true sense, is the ability for transcendence versus the heart. Just to conclude, concerning what you brought, this is the thrust of the idea that Alter Rebbe is conveying. The struggle between these two realities is the theme of the continuation of this very Pedic. Now, concerning the question you brought up in the beginning, that today it's believed that the emotions are totally disconnected with the heart, which would mean that both the intellectual process and the emotional process ultimately are connected only to the mind. So that is a separate issue, and I believe that that's not so simple what you're saying. Because although indeed everything is processed through the mind, and the central nervous system is in the mind, and the awareness and the consciousness, even of the emotions, is only in the mind. But nevertheless, and I think lately, and someone brought it in the beginning of our classes in Tanya, one of the participants, he's not here now, brought it up also. And it was actually in the last few years where they have come to discover that the heart is also connected in a significant way to man's character and identity. Many of us are very weak. And some of us are so weak that we cannot break away from that eye. What is the solution for that? That is a wonderful question. And I think this question is at the core of the whole Sefer HaTanya, and one of the main reasons why the Alter Rebbe has written the Tanya, to address this question. One of the main contributions of the Tanya in this area is that man has to be aware of these two elements in his life, has to be able to identify them, and has to be very well aware of the continuous struggle that exists between them. Because sometimes we come in contact with our divine soul, with our reflective self, with our visionary self, and we experience a certain high. And at that moment, we make a resolution that our life should live based on this vision. And then a few hours pass, or a few days pass, and you see, Yadzichnerstein came bubbamizes, as they say. Don't talk yourself in with celestial illusions. You're basically a beastly animal, domesticated, maybe even undomesticated. And the vision was basically merely a dream. And the heart, the temptations come and tell you, listen, this is right, this is wrong, this is who you are, you want this, go ahead and do it. So often, that sense might imbue man with a sense of despair. Let me not fool myself, let me not deceive myself, let me be honest with myself. We are animalistic creatures, we are often immoral creatures. Yes, we're very intelligent, we might be very poetic, but basically these are heavenly, celestial illusions, merely illusions. So comes the Alter Rebbe and tells you, you should be aware that there are two souls in you. And both are very true. There are two states of consciousness. There is a duality. There is a doubleness of the soul that has to be understood and appreciated. And that doubleness, the average, ordinary man never gets rid of that doubleness, that duality, that multiplicity. There is the unique tzaddik, which we will learn about in the next perek, perek yud, that manages to eradicate himself. But the ordinary man, or the beinoni, and the name of the sefer, sefer shel beinonim, is the guidebook for ordinary people, do not rid themselves throughout their entire life of this multiplicity. There are these two forces that exist. The challenge of man is to identify the two forces, to be aware of the struggle that exists, and finally, although being aware of the conflict that exists, not to allow the impulsive sense of ego dominate his day-to-day behavior. Not allow himself to assert that reality into his thought, speech, and action. So you say we're weak. It's true we're weak. But the point of the Tanya is to guide us and to direct us and to give us the tools, intellectual, emotional, and practicals through which to overcome that weakness, which is the theme that is discussed at length in the following chapters. Yeah. Can you please stand up and speak up? Thank you. It's a good point. In other words, that although not everyone perhaps throughout their life reaches the actual level of the Beinoni in Tanya, which is the man who has the conflict, but nevertheless doesn't allow it to determine his day-to-day behavior, at certain moments or in certain areas, every person can experience the reality of the Beinoni. Huh? No, that's why I didn't say can't. No, that's wrong. A tzaddik. Concerning the level of a tzaddik, not necessarily every human being is capable of reaching that level. The level of the Beinoni, every single human being, no matter who you are, can reach it. But what his point is, that sometimes a person doesn't reach the level of the Beinoni at all times and in all areas, but in certain areas, at certain moments, he experiences the reality of the Beinoni. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. He's adding that concerning what has been spoken about, the relationship between emotions to the heart, or to the mind, to the brain, and so forth. So you're adding one point, that notwithstanding the origin of the emotions, and so forth, the fact is, you're saying that emotions are experienced in the heart, in the sense that the heart is physically affected in a very conspicuous and powerful way by one's emotions versus by one's reflection, contemplation, and meditation, which you're saying is expressed in the heartbeat and other factors that are connected to the space and to the organs of the heart, which underscores a powerful connection between emotions and the heart. In other words, the heart is a physical expression of the nature of man's emotions, whether in the positive side or in the negative side. Okay, that's good. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. You wanted to ask something before?
It seems that you're correlating the animal soul, the Nefesh HaBamis, with the heart, and the Nefesh HaLikis, the godly soul with the mind.
Yes.
Very often when someone's going to go plan a mass murder, he plans the mass murder with his mind. Or if somebody's going to do any other sin or do any other wrongdoing, which impulse comes from the Nefesh HaBamis, he's using his mind to plan it.
That's a good question. That's a good question. It's similar to what you brought up before. If ultimately you're saying the animal soul may manipulate the mind to serve her, how can one discern when he is being motivated by the divine soul and when he's being motivated by the animal soul, if both may use the mind? It's a good question. It's a question which we sometimes have to deal with for a lifetime. The point, again, is that true. They both use the mind. The question is, where does the drive begin? In the mind or in the heart? The question one must always ask himself, and rigorously ask himself, in every single case at hand, is whether the heart is following the mind, or it's the other way around, where it begins in the heart and the mind is ultimately following the heart. One must reflect honestly what is really at the core of his urge, of his drive that he is experiencing. If the urge is being dictated by a vision of what is true and healthy in life, or rather it was evoked by impulses, by fears, by hollow temptations, by insecurities, by laziness, by arrogance, etc., etc., and the intellectual justifications have only emerged later to give these impulses a sophisticated and sometimes even a righteous veneer. It's not always easy. We often become so subjective. The fear or the arrogance or the laziness or the impulses are so tempting and are so overwhelming and influential that they make us subjective and they don't allow us to realize that the beginning of it was all about them. They try to make us think that it was really an intellectual, visionary, reflective drive and vision that dictated them. So it's not easy, but it's the healthy way to live. And the more you do it, the better you get at it. The Rebbe Maharash, the fourth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Shmuel Schneerson, once told his son, later to become the Rebbe Rashab, Reb Shalom Ber, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, when the latter went into his father on Yechidus for a private spiritual audience, the Rebbe told him that the Yetzer Hara, the negative impulse, is called Nefesh HaBahamas, animal soul, not because it is necessarily a brute and crude animal. At times, he said, it may be a fox, the most cunning of beasts. And great wisdom is needed to perceive its various mechanisms, schemes and tricks. At other times, he says, it may clothe itself in the garb of an earnest, straightforward, humble tzaddik, possessing apparently fine traits of character. The animal soul, the Rebbe said, manifests itself in each person according to his individual character. And this is very interesting. One person may suddenly experience a powerful longing to study Jewish spirituality. He says, to study Kabbalah or Hasidism, or to meditate deeply on some spiritual divine concept. The truth is, however, that this is a counsel which stems from the animal soul. It's the animal soul's scheme to prevent him from engaging in actual work of refinement of character, in the humbling work of going and refining an attribute, of humbling himself in front of another person whom he has to communicate with to say a certain truth, whether it's a good friend, whether it's a spiritual mentor, a counselor. It wants to take him away from the act of davening, which means really reflecting on himself and making a resolution to rectify himself and so forth. It says, get involved in spiritual meditation. This is such an exciting divine concept. And the Rebbe told him, and this is one Rebbe talking to a Jew who's later to become a Rebbe. So that's why I guess he used these extremely refined examples to express the subtlety of the schemes that the animal soul may employ. They're by no means coarse, he tells them. They're by no means crude. They can be extremely subtle and even spiritual. But take this as a general principle and remember it always. Any matter that is effective towards or actually leads to active avoda, which means to the productive work of the human being, any matter which is leading in that direction and is confronted with opposition of any sort, even the most noble and subtle opposition, that opposition is the scheming of the animal soul. Which means there can be many motivations and urges and experiences. If you see the bottom line is this motivation is going to lead you to engage in a positive deed, then you know it's coming from the divine side. If this motivation, this reflection, this vision, this impulse is ultimately going to prevent, to postpone, to stop you, to distance you from avoda b'poel, from actually engaging in a practical and concrete way, whether through deeds, whether through words, whether through thoughts, whether through changes, to a positive change in your life, and it's preventing you from it, to actually doing something positive, you know that it's coming from the animal soul. No matter how noble, aristocratic, regal, royal is the motivation and the philosophy behind it. When the Rebbe Rashab said over this, retold this about this conversation he had with his father, he said, until then, I had not known that there can be a pious animal soul, let alone a Hasidic animal soul. Ich hab kemul nicht gewusst, as er kennt sein a frumer nefesh ha-Bahamas, veret nach Hasidische nefesh ha-Bahamas. Apparently, we think the animal soul is defined by its crude, animalistic, egotistical, selfish, self-centered, sometimes evil and beastly impulses. Depends on which level the human being is. Depending on the character of the human being, the animal soul encloses itself in the appropriate garbs for the character and for the identity of this person. But ultimately, the bottom line is that at the core of the animal soul is the blood, the left ventricle of the heart. At the core of the divine soul is the truth, vision, the mind. Both use both. The question is, what is the beginning? The Rebbe would very often tell the following story to illustrate the point. Many times I heard this story from the Rebbe. The holy Reb Nachum of Chernobyler was a very, very poor man. He was, of course, the founder of the great Hasidic dynasty of Chernobyl, and one of the great students of Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, and of his ear, Rabbi Dov Ber the Maggid of Mizrich. And Rabbi Nachum Nachum, the Rebbe of Chernobyl, was extremely poverty-stricken, and he was forever hard-pressed to feed his household. One day, a chassid came and brought him a gift of 300 rubles. The Rebbe's head secretary, who was a very loyal man and committed to the Rebbe, served the Rebbe faithfully and managed his affairs, was extremely relieved. Now he could finally enjoy some tranquility from the heavy debts owed for the various needs of the home and other very many household necessities. Finally he can pay up at least a pretty nice portion of the debts. After the gift-bearing chassid left the Rebbe's room, Reb Nachum of Chernobyl continued to receive his chassidim until he broke for the evening prayers, minchen and ma'ariv, late afternoon prayers and then ma'ariv. After ma'ariv, the Rebbe, for some strange reason, secluded himself in his room. And he engaged in a certain meditation or contemplation. He didn't want to see anyone. After a long while, he finally opened his door and he requested that a certain chassid, one of those whom he had received earlier, before Minchen Ma'ariv, be summoned back to him. The chassid came to him. He was in the Rebbe's room for a very short while. He left, and then the Rebbe continued to receive his visitors late into the night. When the last audience seeker was gone, the Rebbe's head secretary came to request from the Rebbe some money for the needed expenses. He knew about the gift of 300 ruble. He was confident of his ability now to settle at least part of the debts. He had already made a detailed list of how much of the 300 ruble is going to go to each creditor and so forth. Reb Nachum opened the drawer in which he kept maimed money. Maimed money was money which chassidim would bring to the Rebbe to cover his personal expenses. There was money chassidim would brought to the Rebbe for charitable causes, for the Rebbe to distribute to tzedakah. Then there's maimed money, which is the money chassidim give for the Rebbe to support himself and the family. So he opened the drawer with the maimed money, and the Rebbe's secretary sees a drawer full of copper coins with a few silver coins mixed in. Of the ruble notes, there was not a sign. So the Rebbe told him to take the contents of the maimed drawer. The secretary counted the silver and the copper, and they totaled up not even to 100 rubles, This was the money that was in the drawer. The secretary stood there, dumbfounded. He was unable to say a word. He didn't want to bring up the matter of the 300 rubles, but the fact that he saw such an extraordinary gift, and now he was unable to even partially settle some significant amount of the Rebbe's debts, really pained his heart. The Rebbe notices his distress and says to him, "Why are you so upset? He who provides bread to all flesh has in his great kindness sent us a gift, an undeserved gift, from far and wide. Many of our brethren, may they live and be well, have labored and toiled to earn and bring us such a sum." He couldn't contain himself anymore. The heavy debts, the terrible poverty which prevailed in the Rebbe's home, deeply distressed him. And the words flowed from an anguished heart. "But where are the 300 rubles that were brought? Together with what we have here, we would have been able to pay off part of what is owed." "True," said the Rebbe. "I was brought 300 rubles, but let me tell you what happened. A little story happened with these rubles." And here we come to learn what honest reflection means. We learn somewhat of the hard work and toil that a human being has to engage in order to really refine his character and to get in touch with his soul. It's hard work, but it's healthy work, and it's the most rewarding work, because it brings us into a life of real wholesomeness, of real deep tranquility, of not allowing us to live and to fall prey to the shell, but rather to be in touch with the soul. So this is what the Rebbe said. "At the moment that I received the 300 rubles, I wondered, why do I deserve such a large gift? And then I was filled with pleasure at the thought that I had found favor in the eyes of the Almighty, so that He had chosen to provide sustenance for myself, for my family, for my household, in such a generous and honorable manner. But then I thought further, and I was greatly distressed. Perhaps I was receiving this money in place of a spiritual gift." Later in the day, Reb Nachum says, "One of the Chassidim who came to see me poured out his troubled heart. For the past year, he has been unable to pay the teacher of his children, a very poor but God-fearing man who continues to teach the children in the hope that he will someday be paid. And the chassid doesn't have a ruble to pay him. This chassid already owes 8 months' rent for the mill and inn which he leases. And the landowner is sure to evict him soon. To top it all off, he has arranged a match for his eldest daughter, and he has nothing with which to marry her off." When I heard this, it occurred to me that perhaps Hashem has granted me the privilege of being an administrator of such a powerful tzedakah, of such a powerful charity. Perhaps this large sum was entrusted to me so that I may merit such a great mitzvah as educating holy, beautiful Jewish children, as saving the livelihood of an entire family, as marrying off a Jewish bride. I asked the chassid how much his debts and marriage needs amounted to. And what did the chassid say? 300 rubles. It matched the sum exactly. As soon as I decided to give the 300 rubles to this chassid, another thought entered my mind. Is it proper to give the entire sum to a single individual? With such an amount, I can support at the very least 6 entire families. Instead of helping 1 Jewish family, I can help 6 Jewish families. And now I found myself in a serious dilemma. Both of these opinions, to give the entire amount to the one chassid, or to divide it between several needy families, seemed righteous and correct. I couldn't decide between them. Therefore, I locked my door in order to contemplate the matter and reach a decision. What should I do? Both urges, both thoughts in mind, seemed as extremely righteous, as extremely correct, as extremely the proper thing to do. On one hand, there's a Jew in such distress who has so many debts. Let me give the whole money to him. On the other hand, there are so many families that are in such need, that are in such dire need. So let me distribute the money among them. At least I can help a lot. A lot of families. Many families. Upon contemplation, I came to realize that these two opinions were coming from the two souls. They were coming from the two judges within me. From the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara, from the transcendental, divine soul, and from the egotistical, animal soul. The argument to divide the sum among several families was definitely not coming from my divine soul. How did I know? I thought like this. If it was indeed my good inclination speaking, why didn't he speak up immediately? As soon as I received the money from that chassid, the 300 rubles, he should have immediately said, Nachum, 300 rubles were brought to you. Take the money and divide it into six parts. Distribute five parts to needy families and take the sixth for yourself. If this was coming from the divine soul, right when I got this money, the divine soul should have said, Nachum, the right thing to do is distribute the money among all these families. No. This voice spoke within me. This voice spoke within me only after I had decided to give away the entire sum. That gave him away. That gave the animal soul away. When at first I had assumed that the entire sum was meant for me, he was silent. Why didn't he speak up then? Right when I got the money, I thought, hey, beautiful, the Almighty has granted me such a wonderful gift. Then he was silent. Then I didn't hear that, you know, Nachum, why don't you distribute it between six families? No wonder he was quiet. He was perfectly satisfied with my decision. It perfectly suited the character of the animal soul. He was satisfied. He didn't say a word. Only after the Almighty had privileged me to realize why I had been given this money, suddenly he woke up. So how did he wake up? If he would have come and said, keep the money, don't give it to this chassid. You have 300 rubles, keep this money. Oh no, he would never do that. He knows that I would immediately recognize the source of this desire and reject it immediately. He is far too clever at his craft for that, to tell me at this moment to keep the money. He would never do that. He would know, I would immediately know that it's coming from my shell self, from my egotistical self, and therefore I would certainly reject him. So along he comes, the master of cunning, and what does he do? He comes with an utterly pious and logical vision-like suggestion. Anything to prevent me from acting on the role which divine providence so clearly designated for me to play in delivering a Jewish family from distress. So I called the chassid back and I gave him the 300 rubles. Have a good day and a wonderful week.
Rabbi Jacobson delivers this weekly class on the Tanya each Sunday morning at Heichal Menachem in the Borough Park section of Brooklyn, New York. To order additional tapes or to receive the tapes weekly by mail, please call Heichal Menachem at 718-633-1076.